Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire bills itself as having a terrain for all seasons. The mountains offer climbing and skiing, the forests shelter innumerable hiking trails, and the lakes and rivers draw people in summer and winter alike. Everyone has their favorite spots, often with a good story of how they discovered it. But there are other, older stories behind the places we hike or drive past every day. Here to tell us more about some of the state's best-kept secrets is Lucy Breyer. She's author of a new guide called Exploring Southern New Hampshire, History and Nature on Back Roads and Quiet Waters. Lucy, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So in a state with so many natural resources and attractions, how do you even begin to pick for a guidebook like this?
It was difficult, but I started with what I know and what resonates with me. And I've lived in southern New Hampshire my whole life, and I consider it just from the Monadnock region to the Merrimack Valley to the seacoast. I consider it all my big backyard. And so I just have been out exploring for years.
A lot to do in your backyard.
Definitely.
Well, why focus on southern New Hampshire, though? Most people seem to head straight for the mountains, and that's certainly where some of the most famous attractions are.
That's for sure. My approach was to give some attention to those areas that don't receive as much press, if you would. There are some people that are maybe visiting in southern New Hampshire who have lived here for a long time and don't have a full day to devote to go north or to do a full mountain hike. But the type of sites that I've written about are those that you could do in a half a day sometimes, or maybe just as you're wandering through or driving by, you can stop. So there's shorter, quieter sites, I guess you would say.
Well, okay, so you cover three regions here, Monadnock region, the Merrimack Valley, and the Seacoast. Monadnock stands out in more ways than one. The trails are almost always busy. What do you think makes it such a popular site?
I think one of the big attractions about Monadnock is it is so accessible. So you can drive up to the trailhead, park your car. You don't have to have a lot of gear. You can get to the top with a minimal amount of effort. It's about a 3 to 4 hour hike. But then when you get to the top, the rewards are just unbelievable because the top 500 feet of the mountain are clear. So that affords you beautiful views, 360-degree views on a clear day, of course.
I'm reading about all of the different attractions in that region, from the Cathedral of the Pines in Ringe, the Pickety Place, Uncle Sam's House in Maple Sugaring, Purgatory Brook Falls, very interestingly named. How is it that so many things are right in our midst and we know so little about them?
I think what happens is that we are in a rush to get from point A to point B so many times, and we're driving by these sites that are really not far off the road. If people were to stop their car, get out, look around, don't be afraid to drive down a dirt road, don't be afraid to get a little lost. It's amazing what you'll find within a half mile even of the major thoroughfares in southern New Hampshire.
It is so surprising to me because New Hampshire is not particularly low key about its attractions. I don't know. We just don't see historic markers or something like that for many of these sites that you discovered.
We don't. We don't do a great job of signage. Somebody might take offense to that, but we really don't do a lot of signage and information and wayfinding in our state. Half the time you don't know if you've arrived at the spot that you're looking for. So you need to get out of your car, see what's there, and you'll really be amazed.
Well, the intrepid Lucy Breyer is with me. She's author of A New Guide to the History and Nature of Southern New Hampshire. Okay, so let's go to the Merrimack Valley. Would you call a sort of comeback kid? What do you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting. In the Merrimack Valley, what we found is that we destroyed so much of our natural sites. Unwittingly destroyed. We polluted rivers. It happened all over the state, but particularly in the Merrimack Valley.
With the building of mills, you mean?
With the building of the mills. The mills brought a huge population. With the population came more roads. Now we have strip malls. We have big box stores. All of that. Why I call it the comeback kid is because there has been a concerted effort to bring back some of those natural resources. So we have the Nashua River, for example. At one time, it was biologically dead. It was one of the top 10 dirtiest rivers in the country, and the federal government had classified it as a Class U, which is unsuitable for the transport of waste.
Ooh.
And today, it's one of the most beautiful sites to kayak in all of the Merrimack Valley, as far as I'm concerned.
There was a story of particular appeal to me because I'd never heard about it. A history-making sawmill at Turkey Pond. That's right here in Concord, New Hampshire. What happened there?
That's a beautiful, beautiful pond. If you've never been, you need to go. Turkey Pond borders St. Paul's School, and it's about 335 acres there. And what happened in this region in 1938, a big hurricane ripped through all of New England, and it brought down a ton of lumber in our state, so much so that the lumber industry was on the verge of collapse. So the National Forest Service stepped in and said, we're going to help you save your lumber industry. And what we want you to do is to take all these trees that fell and submerge them in the waterways throughout the state. I couldn't understand why would you do that, but they had a reason, of course. It was to protect the trees from insects and from fire until they could be milled into lumber. Turkey Pond was the biggest repository for the fallen trees in the entire state. They created a sawmill on the pond, and everything went well for a few years, and you know they were turning out lumber. And then World War II broke out, and suddenly there was a shortage of men to work at the sawmills. So the people at the Forest Service decided to recruit women to work in the sawmill. And this was something that was totally unheard of at this time. Now, we're talking 1942.
Sort of pre-Rosie the Riveter, even.
Well, it had entered our consciousness, but people certainly did not believe that women could mill lumber.
I love what they called them, Lucy. The
Lumber Jills. Lumber Jills. Yes, I love that.
Yes. Just a wonderful story.
Right. Yeah.
In our very midst, my mom grew up at St. Paul's School, and I had no idea about this.
Yeah.
You know, the Seacoast is probably the most well-known history out of the three regions that you cover, colonial history, you know, buildings, and the first midnight ride of Paul Revere. What?
Well, it's true. We had, on the Seacoast in Portsmouth, there was a fort. Of course, there were seven forts that were built to protect our seacoast in and around Portsmouth. And Fort William and Mary was built in the 1600s. And over time, it became a main munitions post for the colonies. And when King George heard of unrest in the colonies, this now goes to the 1700s, of course, he decided to send troops to take the munitions away from the fort so that ammunition would not get into colonist hands. So in some, I don't know how this happened, but in some way, the people in Boston heard of this. Paul Revere heard of it. He got on his horse and rode to Portsmouth.
And just kind of his thing, wasn't it?
Exactly. December of 1775, and he rode to Portsmouth to warn the colonists that the British were coming to take the ammunitions from the fort. So they gathered about 400 people to ride out on gundalows and secure the fort.
Well, you point out that you can still take gundalow rides on the Piscataqua River there in Portsmouth Harbor. So, Lucy, any advice on where somebody starts? I mean, would you pick an area? Would you pick a path? Would you start with history or a hike? Any ideas?
I think it depends on your personal interest, and that's part of what I tried to bring into the book so that there are some kayaking and canoeing sites. Maybe that's not your thing. There are some walking trails. Maybe that's not your thing. Maybe history is what interests you. So start where you're interested and then pick an area, and I can almost guarantee there's going to be a variety of all of that within one area. I mean, if you choose the town of Exeter, which doesn't seem like a back road area, but we have there an Abraham Lincoln walking tour. If you're a history lover, that's great. If you're not, you can put a boat into the Exeter River. If you prefer a walking trail, Phillips Exeter Academy has walking trails. So it's that type of thing. If you just select one specific area, I can almost guarantee you're going to find a lot of sites that'll speak to your own interests.
Was there one big discovery for you here when you were working on this book?
I did learn about a trail in Peterborough that is fairly new. Basically, this trail will take you from downtown Peterborough to the base of Pac Monadnock. And I had no idea. I mean, this just opened 2 years ago.
Walking, biking, both?
Walking.
Yeah.
A walking trail.
It's the thing about New Hampshire. You just have to kick a few rocks around before you find out what's going on.
That's for sure.
Well, thank you for coming out from under that rock and telling us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lucy Breyer is author of Exploring Southern New Hampshire History and Nature on Back Roads and Quiet Waters. You're going to find a link to more on her book and some of the sites that we talked about at wordofmouthradio.org. And no matter where you choose to explore this summer, you could be getting there for free thanks to NHPR's Early Bird Summer Car Raffle. We'll be back after checking in with Raffle Central here at NHPR.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Everybody loves a bargain, and casual dining restaurant chains are banking on your love of discounts in a big way.
Chili's lunch combo starting at just $6.
But now you can lunch better at Fridays with two items paired for your perfect lunch starting at $6.99.
Only the best make Applebee's famous 2-for-20 menu. Taste what's new in the neighborhood, like our new Honey Pepper Grill. Now part of our 2-for-20 menu. One app, two entrees, only $20. See you tomorrow at late night for half-priced apps.
With prices dipping as low as $20 for two entrees and an appetizer, $6 lunch combos, including soup and salad, restaurants that serve sit-down meals are using fast food price war tactics. The latest chain to up the ante for discounts is TGI Fridays, with a summer promotion that offers bottomless appetizers for $10. That's right, endless potato skin, spinach dip, or mozzarella sticks. Joining us now to shed some light on the marketing philosophy behind this aggressive discount model and the origins of the casual dining price war is Maureen Morrison. She's a reporter for Ad Age, which covers the fast food industry. Maureen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks.
Let's start with TGI Friday's latest summer promotion, the Endless Appetizer for $10. Has the promotion been successful?
Well, I think it's still too early to tell in terms of sales, and I don't even know if they would release that publicly. But I would say that it certainly got a lot of attention in the media.
TGI Fridays is not alone. Tell us about some of the other discounts and deals that these casual dining restaurants are currently offering. And maybe we need a definition of the casual dining restaurant.
Casual dining is typically referred to as sit-down restaurants rather than ordering at a counter or not having a waiter. In these cases, you sit down and then a server comes and serves you.
The Chili's, the Applebee's, the TGI Fridays. What are some of the discounts being offered at these casual dining restaurants?
So Chili's and Applebee's for several years now have been offering a $20 deal that includes appetizers and two entrees. Chili's got a little bit more aggressive when they started offering a lunch combo deal for $6 or $7. And Fridays also does, you know, sometimes a pick two deal for a relatively low price that includes an appetizer and an entree. So these have been going on for a while. And this most recent one, the Endless Appetizers, is really just a more aggressive form of it.
Now, TGI Fridays must have felt some need to offer such a dramatic discount. How's business?
Well, TGI Fridays has been struggling a little bit recently. Their sales have been down to a degree that's probably worrying the company, and they're trying to bring more people in the door by offering more and more aggressive discounts.
It seems like a lot of these restaurants are upping the ante, or I don't know, maybe in discount terms, racing to the bottom. Applebee's offering this lunch deal. Chili responds. You know, one throws down the glove, the next throws down theirs. What set all these price wars in motion?
If I had to guess, I would say that a lot of this is because of the recession. People stopped dining out a lot less, and when they did, they would typically stick with fast food restaurants. But it also is coming as fast casual chains are becoming more and more popular and their business is improving. You look at a company like Chipotle and they're typically in the $7 to $8 range, I think, and people are increasingly becoming more attracted to that business model where it's a little bit cheaper, but it's sort of perceived as nicer than fast food, but it's also faster than a sit-down restaurant.
These are pretty dramatic discounts. I think an appetizer and two entrees for $20. Is that sustainable for the casual dining sector?
Well, I think getting people in the door is probably one of the most important things right now, and I would guess that the hope is that maybe people would order some beer or wine along with that, or they would order some other food to drive up the check price a little bit. In the short term, it's probably sustainable. As far as the long term goes, I'm not sure how long they'd be able to offer something so aggressive, because in the end, if they're a franchise model, the franchisees might start complaining a little bit.
It appears that a lot of these casual dining establishments are vying for the same market share. Mm-hmm. And there can be a couple of different ways to go. You know, you can go deep discount or you can go, you know, we're higher quality, a little bit more expensive, but you get what you pay for. Any casual dining chains going in that other direction?
Well, I don't know if they're trying to market themselves as classier, but you look at a company like Olive Garden and they're trying to rebrand themselves as we speak. And they've remodeled their restaurants and their logo and their menu. So they're clearly trying to become more relevant. And they've come out with smaller plates, which is sort of a trend in the food world. So they're really clearly trying. We'll see how it goes, though.
Where do you think this is going, this price war? Are we going to have $5 entrees soon enough?
Well, I doubt it would get that cheap, but I wouldn't be surprised if they continue to keep the aggressive discounting happening.
Maureen Morrison is a reporter for Ad Age. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
TGI Friday's endless appetizers promotion has been gobbled up by the media. It inspired an analysis of which snack to choose from the numbers guru Nate Silver and a top 10 list on David Letterman's Late Show.
Number two, what wine goes with 1,000 mozzarella sticks?
The promotion also prompted the website Gawker to test the all-you-can-eat promise. The result is not so pretty. Producer Zach Nugent got the full story from Gawker's Katie Weaver, who chronicled her 14-hour search for the end of TGI Friday's endless appetizers.
So before your journey started to the TGI Fridays, your editor gave you some guidelines and an incentive. Can you tell us about those?
Yes. So the original plan was just for me to go, and I said, how long do I have to stay to make it, you know, worthy of a post? And we thought that 6 hours was probably the minimum, that it might be at least kind of interesting to read about. And the hours of this particular TGI Fridays were 11 a.m. to 1 a.m. And he said, if you stay until 1 a.m., I will give you a week off. And I said, okay, well, I'm definitely getting the week off.
So you get to TGI Fridays. Did you decide before you got there that you were going to choose the mozzarella sticks, or was that a decision you made after you had looked at the menu?
I decided before I got there, number one, because I was thinking about the headline that we were going to put with the article, and I thought mozzarella sticks are just a funnier concept than, like, potato skins. There might be some people who don't know exactly what potato skins are. Boneless buffalo wings is really long to write. And I also did not know that the mozzarella sticks were going to be very large, about twice the size of a normal mozzarella stick, and I did not know how they would taste. They tasted in a way that I would say is unlike any mozzarella stick I have ever eaten in my life, and certainly unlike any I hope to eat ever again.
So when you got to the restaurant, did you let the staff there know that you were going to be there for the long haul, or were you kind of going to let them find out on their own?
I was very upfront about it because I thought there's no way to kind of discreetly hang out in a TGI Fridays for 14 hours ordering unlimited food. So as soon as I sat down, I said to my waitress, I like laid it all out. I told her about the vacation days on the line. I said, I'm going to tip very well no matter what happens. So I'm your least important table.
And what was their reaction to that?
She thought it was funny. She thought it was a little crazy. But she also said that for 5 days vacation, she would do it. She thought she could do it. I think a lot of people probably could do it for a week vacation.
Yeah, that's a pretty good prize.
Do you think you could do it?
I think so. I mean, you didn't make the mozzarella sticks sound that appetizing.
I couldn't have eaten like 100 mozzarella sticks for a week vacation.
Right, I was going to ask you about that. It wasn't really about how many you could eat. Like, you kind of paced yourself. So what was your mindset about that?
Yeah, well, I decided when my editor put the vacation time on the line that that was going to be my focus, just staying there late. It wasn't like a sprint. It was a marathon. So I wanted to eat enough that it was still kind of like, oh, wow, she ate a lot of mozzarella sticks. But I wasn't worried about, like, breaking a world record or, you know, killing myself doing it. So I ended up ordering 7 orders, and there are 6 sticks in an order, so that's 42. And of those 42, I ate 32. Like, on every plate, there would maybe be one I wouldn't eat because it would take me so long to get them down because they tasted so bad. But by the time I got to like the last one, it would just be kind of cold and congealed. And it's like, you know what? I have unlimited mozzarella sticks. I'm not going to force this down. I'll just get a new plate.
How did you feel health-wise afterwards?
I would say that I am a very unhealthy eater in general. And I also, I think, got this assignment because I'm kind of known in the office for eating really poorly. And I do a lot of food-related dares. Like I ate, it felt like 3 pounds of basically chicken nuggets one day. So someone would pay for my chicken nuggets the next time we got them. And I, you know, that worked out for me. So I feel like in general, I'm a very unhealthy eater. So it didn't feel super different from my real life. I definitely could picture the cheese kind of clogging my arteries as I ate it. But I didn't feel incredibly sick. I felt, you know, a little sick, as you probably would if you had eaten nothing but 32 mozzarella sticks all day. I didn't have breakfast that day. And I did throw up a little bit when I got home. But I was really thinking, like, when I started, that it could be very bad, that I could be sick the whole time. And that, thankfully, wasn't the case.
So how do you feel about mozzarella sticks in your future?
You know what? I could have eaten them the next day because these did not taste like mozzarella sticks. I would never eat them from a TGI Fridays again if I could avoid it. But I'm totally fine eating them anywhere else. Red Lobster has great mozzarella sticks. If they offered this promotion, I would probably go back and get mozzarella sticks there. Not a problem.
Okay, I guess the final question is, was it worth it for the week off?
Oh my God, absolutely. Yeah, I would do it again in a heartbeat for sure.
Well, Katie Weaver, enjoy your hard-earned vacation, and thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Producer Zach Nugent there with Katie Weaver, proving how far someone will go for a week-long getaway. The winner of NHPR Summer Car Raffle will get pretty far on $2,000 worth of gas. You could go see the Grand Canyon. You could drive to the Everglades. You could even go to Alaska and back. But when we come back, we're going to hear about some more oddball vacation choices, like a factory that makes candy-coated insects, or the Texas Museum, where you can walk through a 27-foot model of the human intestinal tract. That's a tour of America's weirdest places after we check in with the Early Bird Car Raffle.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Most everybody has at least heard of our country's biggest attractions, the Statue of Liberty, the Grand Canyon, Disney World. Not everybody knows about the Spam Museum in Austin, Texas, or Layla's Hair Museum in Missouri. Those are just a few of the sites that Richard Falk compiled in his list of America's ickiest attractions. Our summer car raffle got us thinking about unconventional summer road trips. We pulled out this archival interview with Richard from when his book Gross America, Your Coast-to-Coast Guide to All Things Gross, first came out. I asked him what he's looking for when seeking out gross attractions.
Well, kind of like pornography. I think I knew the gross when I saw it. I did have standards, but I think I did violate them all the time as well. But basically, anytime somebody's insides ended up on the outside, that was valid criteria. That's gross. And then I did try to look for some kind of monstrous insects and crazy wildlife. So,
where do you think you got this instinct or this curiosity about the insides on the outside, et cetera?
I think I just interrogated what I was responding to with the gross, and the stuff that is most, I hesitate to say attractive because it's repellent at the same time, but it's fascinating. It's very similar to the pleasure we take in horror movies, but I think why I prefer the gross is ultimately there's something life-affirming about the gross. Even the medical gross things, they're all about helping people and understanding how the human body works.
No better lead into one of my favorite sounding attractions. Well, there are a number of intestinally related items, which I guess just generally gross, but not the least of which is the intestinal tract model. Now, this is at the Amazing Body Pavilion in Houston. It's large enough to walk through. Tell me about the experience of walking through a giant intestine.
Right. Well, that's at the Health Museum. It's a pretty light gross. It's very kid-friendly. They make it for even toddlers, so it's even less frightening than some of my earliest experiences I remember at Disneyland. So it's, as I call it in the book, it's your child's gateway to the gross. So it's kind of a Lego-colored, you know, Tinker Toy-looking sort of pavilion, very stylized. There's a big spine that forms the dome at the top of the building, and you can look through an enormous eyeball window. It's very cute.
It's an adorable intestine.
It's an adorable intestine.
Also in Houston, the Civil War battlefield embalming diorama. I mean, this is one of those who knew. How did you find these things?
Absolutely. Well, this one I'd searched around for. Not, you know, I have friends that they're really into these museums, but no one had found this one before. Apparently, though, it's very popular, and it's been voted the best attraction in the area for a few years in a row. It's part of the Museum of Funeral History, and it's actually not a morbid place at all. It's by sort of professional undertakers who take a professional pride in what they do. So I had to dig deep to find the gross here, and that was the full-size Civil War embalming attraction. There's no way you can think about embalming at all without getting into the gross. But, you know, it's a really interesting story about how that came. Basically, through the Civil War, that's when Americans decided they needed to embalm people because so many people were dying in war far away from home, and families wanted them one last time to say goodbye. And that's what got people over their horror of embalming. Everyone wanted it suddenly.
I know we've mentioned two from Texas and Houston even, which is interesting, but it doesn't have the monopoly on icky stuff, not even regionally. Which part of the country does have the highest concentration of gross sites?
Well, it gives me great pleasure to say you guys.
No kidding. Well, that's good to know.
The East Coast is very rich, although I do have to say New England is almost gross-free. I saw a lot of things in Boston. I'm sure there's a lot there. I just think you New Englanders like to, you know, keep your cards close to the vest.
Well, one place that you mention a lot is the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia. It was an actual, you know, teaching medical museum in the mid-19th century. It was called a pathological cabinet. It's a place where they collected interesting pathological specimens. You know, this is before, obviously, before the internet, where you could go online and look at movies of sick people, look at 3D models. So to hone your medical skills, you had to go see the real things up close. So they have entire brains, entire organs that are preserved in glass jars of formaldehyde. They have skulls. They have skeletons. All these sorts of, you know, curious medical abnormalities that physicians would go and study. And I have to say it's about 100 years old, but it's a beautiful dark wood and brass, kind of Jules Verne looking place, very beautiful and tranquil. And behind the glass walls are just the most horrific specimens of human ailment and abnormality.
I guess I'm trying to figure out, I mean, all the places that we've mentioned have a certain appeal for a 12-year-old kid, but there seems to be this connection between science and grossness. And I don't know, has that always been there?
I think so. I mean, I'll put it this way. The things that interest me the most about the gross are the things that have a little bit of an interesting background. Sometimes that's just a strange anecdote. For example, the world's best artificial vomit manufacturer is right here in Chicago. So I do have very kind of silly and fun things. I don't have a huge capacity for being grossed out, honestly. So I'm not the kind of guy who can just stare at a jarred fetus for hours at a time. Some people can. What I try to take from that situation is, why am I here? What's compelling me to look at it? And why would anyone want to do this? And that comes up, you know, mostly in these medical contexts. You know, there's a whole hundred, maybe thousands of years history that leads up to that point of a pickled fetus that you're looking at, you know. And I think it's the backstory that appeals to me.
We're speaking with Richard Falk. He's the author of a book called Gross America, Your Coast-to-Coast Guide to All Things Gross, which includes fetuses in jars, as you mentioned, frozen dead guys, candy-coated insects, the world's only poop-fueled street lamp, and so much more. Poop-fueled street lamp, that's in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's a project of a guy who's sort of half artist, half green evangelist, if you want to call him that. It's a guerrilla art project almost that he put in a dog park. There's a machine that's called by the lovely name a digester, which you bury underground, and it's got the right chemical mixture in there that when you put dog poop in there, it breaks it down really quickly and releases the methane and, you know, other combustible gases that you can burn to generate electricity. Actually, we're behind the curve here in the States. Something like this wouldn't raise any eyebrows in India or China. It's even a lot more common in the Scandinavian countries to recycle poop this way. So he's trying to get the word out to us Americans.
Do you have a favorite place, Richard, that you visited?
Well, I think for the Bay Area, I should put out a shout out for the tarantula trek. That's something that just wrapped up. The weekend before Halloween was the last weekend. But there's a hill not far outside of Berkeley here that is home to lots of tarantulas. And the Halloween season is the time they come out to breed. So it's this perfect confluence of nature and Halloween. At this time, the park rangers have these evening tarantula treks where whole families come out with their flashlights and they look for the tarantula men trying to get it on with the tarantula women all across this lovely Northern California golden hillside.
How about the grossest place in America?
I think one of the grossest things and one of the most fascinating for me is the soap. Well, there's a soap man and a soap lady.
What's a soap man or a lady? I'm sorry.
Believe it or not, soap is just a particular form of fat. And so when you die, if you've got the right chemical conditions, your fat can spontaneously turn to soap, which is something that I've never heard of before.
My goodness.
So it takes a good fat person. It takes an airless environment, a little bit of water, a little bit of alkali, and there you go. But you look at these people, and they kind of look like maybe they've been sculpted out of clay. They look a little bit like a mummy with the bandages removed. So it's not really, it's not horrifying. It's just a little weird to look at. But then you see that they're kind of this ochre golden color, and you soon realize that that's all fat that's turned to soap. And this, for me, is just a perfect example of just the bizarre things a human body can do that's gross. But your curiosity trumps any sort of visceral horror, and you just want to know, how can this happen?
I'm not sure I'm at the curiosity stage yet. Well,
it takes a while. You got to build up calluses. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Richard. It's just a fascinating book, and I appreciate your time today.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. It was a great time.
Richard Falk, a freelance writer and editor and author of Gross America, your coast to coast of all things gross. He's grossed us out today, and he'll do it for you. You can look online and find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Whether you're curious about visiting the bizarre Grotius Maximus sites that Richard talks about in his book Gross America, or contemplating a drive down to the Cape, you could do it all on NHPR. It is the early bird phase of NHPR Summer Car Raffle. You can help pay for the news you depend on and maybe get yourself a whole mess of free travel and gas. Here's how.